I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC at 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Scott Carpenter was the fourth American in space and the second to orbit Earth, but as you probably know from the book and movie The Right Stuff, his achievement was hardly greeted with the same enthusiasm as his colleague John Glenn's. Soon after his spacecraft took off on May 24, 1962, it malfunctioned, forcing him to overshoot his landing site by 250 miles. His judgments during the flight were subsequently criticized, and he never manned a spacecraft again. In For Spacious Skies, Mr. Carpenter reveals what really happened on that flight and also how he came to be a space pioneer in the first place. The book is from Harcourt and was written with his daughter, Christover. I'm very pleased that it has brought Scott Carpenter to my show today. Hello.
And good afternoon to you, sir.
Your personal journals and flight logbooks, which you replicate in this book, give your account of the 5 hours you spent in space, also your splashdown. Can you summarize the events for us? It all began
the most incredible experience you could ever ask for.
Well, first of all, just going up there must have been the most incredible experience.
That's what I speak of.
Mm-hmm. But what about the malfunctioning pitch horizon scanner?
That was not part, at least by that name, of the experience, because that failure was not known about until well after the flight was over and post-flight analysis had been done. It was a serious malfunction, but you know, this is experimental flight test, and you expect things to go wrong.
But I would have assumed because of that that they would have looked first to the technology and not blamed the human involved.
Well, there are problems created by humans throughout the flight in the design, the concept, the fabrication, the testing, the operation, the recovery, and the post-flight analysis. Mistakes are made everywhere, but it's always the case when you try to do something for the first time.
What was the pitch horizon scanner supposed to do before it malfunctioned?
It was among the instruments that would allow the man aboard to determine his attitude in yaw. That's turn left, turn right. Without accurate knowledge of yaw, the flight path after retrofire is affected, and mine happened to be affected in a manner that made me go 250 miles farther than we expected.
The Right Stuff made it clear that astronauts were direct descendants of the test pilots, people like Chuck Yeager. You were a test pilot for several years in the 50s. What was that like? Was it anything like what you experienced in space?
Part and parcel. Everybody in the early days was a trained test pilot. That's what it took in those days because that was an experimental flight test program. It changed over the years, and now we take trained scientists rather than trained pilots. NASA quite rightly figured that if you need to do science in space, you should take trained scientists and teach them about flying, rather than taking trained test pilots and teaching them about science and it stands to reason.
Well, you weren't expected to do any science when you were up there. This was the earliest time. We were just trying to figure out how to make these things fly, weren't we?
Well, no. We did that with John, and I had been assigned a flight devoted to science. And I remember thinking, what I am here for is to evaluate space, not the machine that got me there. And therein lies the classic internecine warfare between pilots and engineers, scientists and engineers, and on some occasions, pilots and scientists. Mine was a science flight, partly by inheriting it from Deke's flight, but partly by my own design. And that flew in the face of a lot of accepted reason, and territories were violated. and that caused vocal disagreement.
Well, you and the other Mercury astronauts fought to be functioning test pilots of your spacecraft, didn't you? Not just passengers or spam in a can, as some people have called it. Today, the scientists that go up are pretty much spam in a can.
Well, I disagree. Spam can't do the work that a human can in space.
I'm talking about the flying part.
Well, we've still got people who can fly, and the fact of the matter is that's another thing that came from my flight. It is a fact of the matter that had there been no pilot aboard, no man on board with a window he could see out of, the flight would not have come home safely.
Mm-hmm. 250 miles or not, you wouldn't have even been back.
That's right.
Now, of course, America wasn't the first to put people in space. The Soviets had already done it. What was the link? You were a test pilot at the time. Was there a direct link with the Soviet success and your being trained?
No, the training on both sides of the Iron Curtain was accomplished as a prerequisite to our being chosen as an astronaut. Then we went through.
Well, so we were already on the program before Yuri Gagarin went up there.
Yes, but we both had teams selected for that purpose. The Soviets just got there first, and as a matter of fact, the competition between the Soviets and the Americans was a driving force, mainly because of the satisfaction required by all of us of our curiosity, but more important, because in those days of the Cold War, supremacy in spaceflight was viewed as a condition of our national security.
And this was something that came out of the military services and several government agencies. Did that confuse the issue more? Now we just have NASA, but then there must have been competition within government agencies, as there always is.
Oh, of course. And that's the part and parcel of the internecine warfare going on that some people got very vocal about, and that was a crude reaction to the violation of territory. All of the heroic astronauts came as upstarts to the cadre that existed before we got there, and we stepped on some of their toes.
Was it important for the early astronauts to come from the various branches of the military? You came from the Navy, didn't you?
Yes, and I don't to this day know whether it was a function of political correctness or not, but we had in the first group 3 Air Force, 3 Navy, and 1 Marine. Go figure.
You were also in Air Intelligence School at the time.
Had nothing to do with it, really.
In January of 59, you received 2 mysterious letters from an Admiral Peary. What did the letter say?
Come to Washington, and when Admiral Peary says, do something, we do it. He doesn't need to say please, and he said, further, do not discuss or speculate with anyone the reason for these orders.
Did you have any idea?
None. Till I got on the airplane and read a short item in Time magazine. It said military aviators are being ordered to Washington to fly a new kind of craft. And it raised the question in my mind.
Mm. How many people were actually brought to Washington?
I think 69 ended up receiving orders. No, there was 110 originally. 69 volunteered.
Actually, there were originally 508 candidates, weren't there?
Yes, but many of those didn't have the required college degree in aeronautical engineering or related science or they were too tall or otherwise physically unfit.
Height was important, and
5'11" max.
That's because you couldn't fit in there otherwise?
So we're told.
What about weight?
No, that was sort of automatically taken care of with the physical requirements.
I read somewhere that for every extra pound, an additional 1,000 pounds of fuel was required for launch, so they didn't want people who were bulky.
No, but they couldn't take people who were tall.
Now, who evaluated you? Were you put through a series of tests?
3 solid weeks, the most thorough investigation of the human physiology and intellect, I think, that has ever been designed.
And they were looking at a lot of different kinds of people, parachute jumpers, deep sea divers, Arctic explorers, mountain climbers, probably because they wanted people who were brave.
I don't know what motivated that, but Eisenhower said, we'll take these men from the ranks of jet-qualified military test pilots.
We didn't even have a name for what they were going to do. Some of the names that they had were Spaceman, Superman, Space Pilot. My favorite is Man in a Can.
That came afterward.
Aeronaut, Argonaut. The Russians had taken Cosmonaut, which is very nice. That means sailor of the cosmos, doesn't it?
Sure, and we were sailors of the stars. Cousteau had men in the ocean, and he called them oceanauts. The United States Navy had men in the ocean, and they were aquanauts, men who drive underwater research vessels are hydronauts.
Was everyone enthusiastic about this? Were all the candidates hot to be part of Mercury?
The 69 we spoke of were the remainder, of course, were not, and they didn't volunteer.
Some did disqualify themselves for career reasons or other reasons, and perhaps some didn't, were just afraid. I know I might be.
I don't think any of the those fellows were. They were all military aviators, jet pilots. They don't have to worry about that. They didn't disqualify themselves. They just said no thank you.
Scott Carpenter is one of the 7 original Wright Stuff astronauts and the 4th American in space. He's written a book with his daughter Christover called For Spacious Skies, The Uncommon Journey of a Mercury Astronaut, published by Harcourt. We'll continue right after this. Scott Carpenter is one of the 7 original Wright Stuff astronauts and the 4th American in space, the second to orbit the Earth. And he has joined me on WNYC at AMA 20, online at WNYC.org, also FM 93.9. He's written For Spacious Skies with his daughter Chris Stover, and the book is published by Harcourt. The Wright Stuff will come up again and again. Did you like the book and the film?
Both, very much.
Mm-hmm. He got it right.
He did, but I have to admit the possibility that my affection for the book and for the film as well is colored a bit by my great affection and respect for Tom Wolfe.
Also, it doesn't hurt to be played by a very handsome movie star.
He called me one day and said, guess who I am, Scott? And he's an actor. I was happy for him because he needed work. But over that period, we cooperated a lot and had a lot of fun together. But there's one thing I really didn't care too much about him. He's a scratch golfer.
And that's that would make you judge somebody negatively.
That raises the competition some.
Well, you were put through all sorts of tests and experiments at the time. Did we really know what traveling in space would entail? Those experiments with the high G loads, 0G, cosmic radiation, et cetera, sensory deprivation, were they all done well?
Yes, but many were unnecessary, it turned out later. We were the guinea pigs, and we did a lot of testing on the early fellows that was not required and no longer done.
What did the data indicate in terms of who might be a good candidate for spaceflight?
The tests given during that phase proved the validity of the selection process. So there was no problem there, and the actual flights proved the validity too. But it also proved that we were too cautious, but we didn't know that beforehand.
You reveal that you were fascinated by the psychiatric interviews.
Well, I was fascinated by them all. The interesting thing about the psychiatric work was that there is some psychological stress in space flight, but it's easily withstood by a good man. What those brilliant psychiatrists did not realize at first was the fact that the major stress of space flight would be attending the post-flight loss of anonymity. And that undid a lot of folks.
And they did look into that in an odd way, didn't they? Because they were checking into likability, sense of humor, articulateness. And those are the sorts of things that might help in that post-flight loss of anonymity.
Well, possibly. I don't see a connection there, but I do know that the selection process proved itself, and that that sort of psychiatric investigation is no longer done.
But what I meant was most of the people, I've spoken to any number of people who have been through this, and they all were relatively gregarious. And I would think that that would help in dealing with all that public attention later.
Yes, that was measured. It continued to be measured afterward, but the loss of anonymity being unsuspected from the beginning was never, that stress was never evaluated.
You say that beyond the data that showed spaceflight would be both physically and emotionally demanding, the speculation as to what would go on in space was wild. How wild? What were they speculating?
A lot of the speculation was wild, but that's what you expect when you do something for the first time.
Like what? Eyeballs exploding? Things like that?
That was a suspicion only, but nobody knew.
Mm-hmm. Nobody knew whether the heart would beat normally in outer space.
Absolutely, but that's an unknown that no longer
exists.
Whether
you'd be able
exists.
To swallow, whether you'd be able to digest food, all those basic things, whether space radiation would burn retinas or sterilize people. There were a lot of people who were worried about being sterilized, and then there were all those people who worried that you'd come out of the capsule and you'd be bringing some terrible disease from outer space that would wipe out humanity.
That's right. I remember thinking during those times that this is a very undemocratic situation we're in. We were assumed to be guilty of all of these disabilities, and we had to prove our innocence.
But were you worried at all that one of those things might happen?
I knew better. We could do that.
And then in April of 1959, you and six other men were chosen as the Mercury astronauts. Did you have much in common with Cooper, Glenn, Grissom, Wally Schirra, Alan Shepard, Donald
Slayton? We're all from the same block.
Uh-huh. So, and do you think that you were similar as people? Could you recognize yourself in those men?
Yes. I think that group of seven, first of all, is the unique fraternity of all times, and we are very similar in many ways, but with healthy differences as well. And the esprit de corps and the camaraderie, I am proud to tell you, it exists. It endures.
You mean you remain friends or
yes,
at least acquaintances?
Indeed.
Can you point to anything or anyone in your childhood and your young adulthood that contributed to your being chosen as a part of this elite group?
I assigned that responsibility to my father figure, who was my maternal grandfather. He made me what I am.
And you devote a lot of this book to your family and your upbringing.
Yes, that is really what inspired it. And I think part of their value to me is the fact that they were two generations ahead of me instead of just one. And I got some training from those old folks that my peers didn't get from their parents. That made me feel very confident.
Well, what sort of training are you talking about? After all, the idea of space travel had to be totally beyond their thinking.
Yes, but not their pioneering. They were real pioneers, and there were none of those among their younger generation until the space program came along.
So that was, as we remember from Star Trek, the last pioneer. The last frontier.
Well, there is one in the ocean.
I screwed that up.
There's one in the ocean. But anyway, pioneering was our generation's grandparents' experience.
So your grandparents were real pioneers? They traveled across
indeed.
The country? My guest is Scott Carpenter. He's written with his daughter, Christopher, For Spacious Skies, The Uncommon Journey of a Mercury Astronaut. It's published by Harcourt. This is WNYC at 93.9 at AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. You said the one thing you couldn't have been prepared for was all the attention. How did the press and the public react to the fledgling space program back in 1959? I know Life magazine sure gave it a big play.
The press fell in love with it. The whole country fell in love with it. And that helped us do our job better because it increased the responsibility that we had in the eyes of the public. But the most important exterior force as a driving force was the competition with the Soviets. As an interior driving force, it was curiosity.
How did Life wind up getting involved in it? Did it have that much clout that it could get an almost exclusive?
It had a lot of clout, but it also appealed to NASA because if there was exclusivity given to any one person, it would be better for them because they wouldn't have to deal with competition among the press members. And furthermore, Life recognized, I think correctly, the value of exclusive reporting on the space program. So everybody liked it.
How did your wife of the time, Renee, feel about all the hoopla and about your going in space? And what about your kids? You had a couple of them, including your co-author, Chris.
They all loved it. But they're military people to begin with, so this is not new.
But that had to deal with celebrity as well. Suddenly everybody was curious about them. They couldn't just go to school.
The kids took to it okay, and the wives did too. Navy wives and Air Force wives, even Marines wives, are pretty flexible.
So it's not the reason you wound up being divorced from Renee or the wives
that followed? Oh, it had something to do with that acclaim, but I think, you know, some people just grow apart, some grow together.
NASA gave you desert survival training. They simulated the experience as best they could. How do you even come up with ways of preparing people for something that's never been done before?
Try them in every conceivable environment.
And do you think it was good preparation, finally?
Absolutely.
Why was John Glenn chosen to be the first man to go into orbit?
You have to ask Bob Gilruth and the rest of the people in the front office. I think the peer rating was important in that selection, but it's something none of us knew much about.
Your relationship with Chris Kraft, NASA's first flight director, grew strained after your flight, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But what was it like during your pre-flight days? Why were you and John Glenn his most vexing problems, as you put it?
Whose most vexing problem?
Chris Kraft.
Oh, well, yeah. We were members of a new group of upstarts that stepped on some toes and violated established territory. And that didn't set right with a lot of the old-timers. Chris Kraft was just vocal about it. I think that was a crude reaction and a disloyal reaction to the team and to NASA in general and to this grand and glorious pursuit of manned spaceflight.
Well, he considered you the Shackleton of the project and called John Glenn the cover boy.
And he thought Wernher von Braun was worthless. And all of this astounds me.
Well, he was on the show a couple of years ago, and he accused you of wasting precious fuel sightseeing in space and of ignoring an instrument discrepancy that resulted in that 250-mile off-course landing.
Yeah, that's the best I can say about that is that he got it wrong, maybe by unconscious design because of his threatened territory.
Mm. Well, he is credited with saying Scott Carpenter will never fly again.
He said something more than that. He said Scott Carpenter will never fly for me again. He got that wrong, too. We didn't fly for him.
Now, you have told us your account of your flight in Splashdown. Why is his version so different from yours? I understand that it took a while for them to figure out some of the technological bugs, but eventually he must have known about it just like you.
But didn't acknowledge it because, well, I don't know. I can't answer for him. But his animus has been always an unknown to me.
Well, Tom Wolfe wrote in The Right Stuff that you were having a picnic during your flight.
Of course I was, but I was doing my work.
You wouldn't do anything differently in retrospect?
I would allow more time for the inability to do things as quickly as the flight plan demanded. But I was there to do science, and the value of that flight, in spite of what anybody says, is it stands on its own.
If you were given the opportunity that John Glenn was given, what was it, 4 years ago now, to return to space, would you do it?
Sure. I told John I would gladly stand by for him again for that flight, which was to evaluate the effects of weightlessness on aged people. But I said NASA would probably not allow it because I wasn't old enough. I also added that...
And you hadn't been in Congress either.
Well, that helped him, but I furthermore said that I would stand by him. And this time, however, I would make sure he broke his leg so I could take the flight.
Are you happy with the way the NASA programs have developed over the years?
Yes, but NASA doesn't chart its own path. NASA is not sufficiently supported by the American public, and we're going in the right direction, but too slowly.
Well, you had that problem with that technology, and more recently we had a space, what was it, a Mars probe, where half the scientists were doing all the calculations in inches and feet, and the other half were doing it in the metric system. And we had a crash, so nothing seems to change.
Well, it's part and parcel of experimental flight test. It's because humans are involved, and humans are fallible.
After Project Mercury, you went to sea, didn't you? The other frontier.
I did.
What were you doing for the U.S. Navy?
Learning how to support men in the hostile environment of the ocean.
Underneath or on top?
Underneath, living permanently, so to speak.
So you're in the sea
high
land.
Pressure in an underwater habitat that was open to the ocean, pressurized so that the water didn't run in. And we were functioning experimental and exploratory divers living permanently on the ocean floor.
And now you retired and live here in New York and in Vail, Colorado?
Correct.
Well, this is another frontier, but we'll talk about that some other time. Scott Carpenter and Chris Stover, S-T-O-E-V-E-R, have written for Spacious Skies, The Uncommon Journey of a Mercury Astronaut. It is published by Harcourt. And thank you, Scott Carpenter, so much for being with us today.
Pleasure.
You looked exactly the same as you did when you were younger, except for the crew cut.
Not as far as I'm concerned, but...